Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Now in depth on truth in fiction and nonfiction. My guest is one of those rare writers who can move effortlessly between novels and nonfiction. Denis Bouchard's war reporting brings us into the world of Afghan women testing their freedom on bicycles for the first time, or a Kabul military academy that's training young and diverse recruits. His new novel is certainly influenced by his journalism, but it gives us a fresh look into the kind of people who are drawn to war zones as observers. Mr. Bouchard has said, finding narrative solutions in nonfiction makes me think more creatively about fiction and vice versa. Denis Bouchard's new novel is titled Into the Sun, and he's with me in the studio. And welcome. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
I think that's an interesting phrase, narrative solutions. What's it mean to you?
It means a lot of things. It depends on the narrative problem I'm facing. So sometimes I want to tell a story, and I'm not sure exactly how to get to the heart of that story. And I will, if I'm working on nonfiction and I'm trying to tell the story, I have a certain amount of material to work with that forces me to think very creatively about how to construct a narrative that is coherent from the truth, from
right.
what I have. And so sometimes that forces me to push the boundaries of what I would normally think of doing with fiction, for example. I don't know if that makes sense.
Okay, no. I want to make sure I understand what you just said. So when you're dealing with journalism and you're writing a story, you have a set amount of content and reporting that's come in
on that,
right? And those can be limiting. I mean, that can be limiting in what you're going to write.
Well, it can be very limiting. Yeah, absolutely. You know, with fiction, you can sort of invent. You can invent the missing pieces, and if someone's telling you their story, you have to be able to dig into it and find where did the person get transformed? What was the transformative moment in this story?
Right.
What did the person experience that led to this outcome? And people don't always give you enough information right away. And so, as a journalist, I learned to be much more patient and to kind of try to find those places.
As a journalist or as a fiction writer, did your fiction writing inform that for your journalism too?
I think both ways. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, as a fiction writer, you know what it takes to tell a good story. And when you're interviewing somebody, you can hear when you're missing the pieces to get that story.
It's also a case of where maybe you come back to write, let's say, the journalistic piece, and there's that one moment of it that you wish you had, that if you were writing fiction, you'd be inventing, but you can't do that because you're writing journalism.
Exactly.
I'm not saying you're tempted to do that. I'm just saying that you probably experienced that.
Yes. Yeah. And I think with over time, now I know to make sure I don't leave the interview until I have those questions asked.
No, you've learned that from me. You know that writers, I believe this, I'm interested in whether you believe it, that fiction can tell the truth about pretty complicated ideas and problems. I think in a way that sometimes journalism can't.
I absolutely agree with
that.
Do
you?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, why do you think that is?
I think it's because, I mean, it depends on the form of journalism. It depends on the space one has. You know, if someone's writing a 300-page journalistic book telling the story of one person's life, they can, I think, have a very profound impact in terms of creating character that the reader can relate to. I think that fiction gets under the skin, right? When you're a journalist, you don't really have the right to say this is what someone's feeling. The journalist has to hold back their empathy.
Wow, right.
And as a fiction writer, you can really empathize and build a character that someone's going to inhabit. Someone's going to be inside for 400 pages. And they're going to experience these events in a visceral way. And people rarely come to their viewpoints through rational process. You know, if we all came to our viewpoints through rational process, we'd have a much more functional country and world. You know, people are emotional. They have emotional reactions, and then they rationalize them afterwards.
That's so true. That basically sums up the whole American presidential election right there.
Yes,
what you just
I would
said.
Say so.
I don't want to let you off without exploring the idea that journalists have to hold back their empathy. Isn't that Isn't that some of what is not moving about some journalism that should be?
Yeah, I think it's tricky. I guess I don't want to say that it's, you know, when I'm doing a long form piece, for example, I actually just finished one recently that was a profile of somebody, hasn't come out yet, but it's, when I'm writing it, I try to be very careful. I'm very careful about speculating. You know, there's a sort of speculative mm-hmm. space with empathy where you can imagine what the person is feeling, mm-hmm. and I don't want to put words into someone else's mouth. And so I use my empathy to guide the interview. I think this person's something much deeper is happening right here, mm-hmm. and I need to ask some questions in this moment and
right.
get to the heart of what that person's feeling in that moment. But when I'm writing it, if I don't actually have the material, if they haven't actually said it, I don't want to say it. I will call them up again and say,
"You know, it's so tempting, isn't it?
It's tempting, yes. But that would no longer be journalism, you know, that in that moment. And so I think that empathy has to guide the process. It guides the shaping of the narrative. We have to feel where that person was most like. People don't always share their trauma; they're not quick to share. So you have to kind of pay attention and. I pay attention and I try to follow their story to get a sense of where I think the hotspots are, essentially.
Yeah.
And then I come back to those in the most careful way possible. But at the same time, whereas with fiction, there's a space to – I can fully inhabit the character. I can imagine myself in that character's body and their life and create an experience for the reader that is there's a real freedom to create a very complex human being. And I think journalism aspires to do that, absolutely.
Right.
But there's also the question of form. There's rarely the space to do it as well.
You're also a writer of a memoir. I think the last time we talked, we were talking about your memoir. And I had a conversation last week with Elizabeth Alexander, the poet and memoirist. I don't know if you've read her newest memoir, The Light of the World.
No, I haven't. No.
About the loss of her husband 4 days after his 50th birthday. And we were talking about truth. I mean, she writes beautiful poetry, but about how different the idea of writing her truth was in that memoir. So I thought if you could listen to this, we can talk about it.
As a writer and as a poet, you're always trying to make every syllable true. It has to sound true and it has to have truth of content in it. But I think that, you know, following, profound loss, the truth demand is even more profound.
What, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does make sense. I mean, when I lose the most sleep is usually when I'm lying in bed wondering if what I wrote was true. You know,
really?
if sometimes, especially because fiction is so, you know, we live in a very commercial society, it goes without saying, and there's a great pressure on fiction writers to write commercial books, the mm-hmm. books that are going to have a certain plot. And we're constantly absorbing narratives. You know, every time you turn on the TV, every time you listen to a podcast or an audiobook, we have a very dramatic narrative form that Hollywood has sort of programmed into us and that we expect to a certain degree. And sometimes I wonder, is the narrative form I'm using true to the characters, or am I imposing it on the characters? Is the way I'm telling
this... In fiction or in journalism?
I wonder about it in everything I
really?
Do.
Really?
Yeah. And certainly with fiction, I worry about it a lot. And I always wonder, you know, is the story I'm telling true? Am I trapped within my own small experience of the world?
Yeah.
You know? Am I able to get out of my small experience? And you know, is someone else who went to Afghanistan going to relate and say, yeah, this is accurate? This, you know, and so I try to... Sometimes, you know, we all have this. Everyone has a bad experience or a good experience somewhere, and they build a story around it,
uh-huh.
right? And so I spend a lot of time trying to examine my stories and take them apart and see if there's truth to them and if, you know, there's a real resonance there or if, you know, sometimes that feeling, for example, when you read a story that has a moral at the mm-hmm. end and you kind of feel it's not true, it's too simple,
uh-huh.
it's too closed. Life is more complex than that.
Yes.
And whenever I write something, I always sort of evaluate it to try to make sure that I'm giving it the complexity of life.
Don't you think that a lot of our escapist fiction is precisely what you've described? And to some degree, it's popular because it gives us something that real life doesn't.
Absolutely. It gives us closure.
Your novel's just simply too complex. Too much like real life, right?
Yeah, well, I hope so.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's hard to read. No, but it's not, actually. But so the thing that keeps you up at night is, does my fiction ring true to my own experience, or is this gonna be true as the reader kind of inhabits the world that I've created? I'm trying to figure out what it is you worry most about when you're writing fiction.
Right. I worry that it's going to I worry that it's authentic, right? That if I'm writing for
the reader's not going to know that, probably.
Well,
that's the thing.
Sometimes when I read novels, there's moments where I feel as if the writer is being influenced by a generic narrative.
Oh.
You know, that they kind of fell into a plot rut and followed it, and as opposed to really examining the complexity of that character and letting that character make choices that are maybe more surprising, more unusual, more, you know, it can take many different forms. There's no one way, but it's, I think that I often watch movies, and I think, you know, it's with that feeling of predictability, right?
Yes.
And it's not, there's a good predictability where you think, you know, this is somebody who's like this. This is, you know, if you put all these details into a character, the weight of those details will lead to certain consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also the predictability of this is just the form. This is just where it goes.
I think a lot of us find that pretty comforting.
See, I find it pretty boring.
I do too.
Yes.
But I think there's a reason that I mean, why is the sitcom so popular?
Right,
we're gonna wrap up the scenario and the shallow moral dilemma in 30 minutes.
Absolutely.
And everybody's gonna live happily ever after till the next week.
It gives us, you know, it gives us some order to a very complicated life.
Right.
As opposed to allowing us to experience some catharsis in the chaos, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm more interested in taking a reader into a space that's extremely chaotic, extremely confusing, without the narrative being confusing, but, you know, to show us the complexity of life, to let us experience a situation where there is no good answer, and to offer an experience of that, you know, in a classical sense might be slightly cathartic, that'll allow them to make more peace with the chaos of life as opposed to just closing it off.
So if you catch yourself writing towards a moral, which you probably have, right?
Oh, absolutely.
As you've gained more experience as a writer, what happens?
If I catch myself
writing to a moral,
I stop and I go back to the beginning and I begin looking through the story again and trying to relive it and see and really see, you know, where I fell into that prefabricated narrative.
Don't most good novels, though, have some kind of moral that might not be obvious, might not be the obvious one that we can see, but isn't that at the center of most really good literature?
Well, I guess, you know, maybe there's a distinction to be made between themes and morals.
Okay.
You know, they're great themes, I certainly think, and you know, sort of, I'm skeptical when I finish a book and I feel that the author wrote the book to try to give me a very precise message.
You want to name names the last time that happened?
Yeah, no.
No. Okay. Yeah, you're skeptical of that. Why?
Because I think it's also important for a reader to be able to make decisions within the text, while you're reading. You know, with each step of the reading process, you're making a decision as to, you know, there's this is a very long discussion. It's like, you know, there's a question of reliability. You want to know, you know, not all narrators are reliable. You want some space for yourself to make decisions, to judge whether the narrator is presenting it accurately.
Mm-hmm.
And to construct that narrative, you know, the reader should be, I think, complicit in constructing the narrative and working towards some tension between interpretations, you know, the interpretation the author is trying to create and leaving some space for the reader to have an interpretation that is at odds possibly with what the writer is even presenting. And I think when there's a moral, I feel that the writer is omitting things and trying
omitting
to,
or emitting?
Omitting.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Omitting things. Omitting is sort of reducing the story, reducing the characters to direct my interpretation in a strict way. And that I find to be slightly less honest, like less authentic.
Except that, you know, we don't live in an amoral world because it's chaotic. There are moral conclusions that we can draw.
Yeah.
Right. Even it. So it isn't that if there's going to be some kind of moral, you've taken the easy way out.
Right. you know, we can live in a moral world in the sense we live in a world with, you know, ethical values and ethical standards. I guess, you know, to make the distinction between an ethics versus a lesson, right? Mm-hmm. When we talk about moral in the sense of a lesson, you know, is this a fable with a lesson? Is it a parable? You know, I prefer to think that I'm not writing lessons for people, that I am presenting an experience of the world that allows people to experience something they might never have thought was possible, mm-hmm. and to come away with a different view of events or people or places. But I rarely feel that I have the solutions when I'm writing. I think when people offer me an easy solution in a book, I find it to be dishonest because I don't go through life thinking...
In some other novel that you'd be reading.
Yeah. I don't go through life thinking there are many solutions to most big problems. That's why we're always coming back to those big problems in life, because they are complex. There are thousands of ways to look at them. It's why we have so many different philosophies, so many different spiritual views, so many different political views, because it's not easy to figure those things out. And so when I talk about moral, I'm resistant to reading a book that has a lesson, that you know, Ayn Rand or something that's going to say, you know, this is wrong and this is right, or, you know, Animal Farm or what it may be, right? And I think some people do it more overtly and some people do it very subtly. Anytime anyone's writing anything, we're always at risk of doing that because we're always trying to create meaning.
I'm really glad you mentioned a couple of those titles, because what was running through my mind were all the classics, contemporary and more and older classics that we read as kids in school.
Yeah.
And often part of the training of trying to understand literature is finding the moral. We're disposed to that from a very young age in the way we analyze literature.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we study O. Henry and, you know, quite early in school. And if there's anyone who's hammering a moral into our heads, it's O. Henry.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Animal Farm. I couldn't stand the book Lord of the Flies. Go back through a lot of that stuff that we both read as students.
Yeah.
You're pushing back against, you know, decades and decades of great literature.
Yeah. I think there's a form of moral training going on there.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
it's
right.
Trying to train the sensibilities. But I, you know, I think we're sort of in a post-epiphany culture when it comes to literature, where we're not looking for the big lesson to emerge I would say that, if anything, we're trying to sort of take apart those lessons, leave space for the writer to, inhabit uncertainty. And what I would say is that when I write, I probably start more from a place of conviction. You know, I don't think about what's the moral I'm going to deliver. I think about what's my conviction. Why am I so compelled to write this story? And I don't really let myself think about writing a novel until I know that there's a conviction of something I think needs to be examined.
Okay, so we'll get a look at the latest news, and when we come back, we'll talk about... You want to take a breath?
No, yeah, it's fine.
We'll talk about the conviction that kind of led you to the setting that you've written about, which is this idea of why some people are drawn to a war zone, right? This expat journalist, mercenary kind of community that would be drawn to a place like Afghanistan. So we'll talk about that on the other side of news, but now to Mike Moen. Hi, Mike.
Hello. A rescue worker who witnessed the strikes on a warehouse and trucks carrying UN aid in Syria says more than 20 missiles pounded the area for hours, even hitting his team as they searched the debris for survivors. He says the strikes came from helicopters and land missiles. Syria and Russia have both denied involvement in the attacks. This morning, President Obama told world leaders that the benefits of global integration need to be broadly shared. He says the global economy needs to work better for all people, not just those at the top. Obama was addressing the United Nations for the final time as president. Florida's Attorney General Pam Bondi is defending her decision to accept a $25,000 donation from Donald Trump while her office was fielding consumer complaints about Trump University. Bondi today, for the first time, directly answered questions about the 2013 donation from Trump's Family Foundation. She says she has no regrets about accepting the money and repeated that her office did nothing improper. And the pipeline company, working to repair a leak that led to gas shortages and higher prices for drivers across the South, says its bypass repair is complete and it expects to restart its main gas line tomorrow. Colonial Pipeline spokesman Steve Baker says testing is now being done on the line. He says crews have been working around the clock to get fuel to the markets. In the Twin Cities right now, we have a mix of clouds and sun. It's 64 degrees. More news ahead on Minnesota Public Radio News. It's 10:37.
Some Somali Americans are trying to set up community resource teams, imams, therapists, and others who can help counsel young people tempted by extremist ideology. I'm Kathy Warzer. Listen for that story and all the latest news tomorrow on Morning Edition.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, Eric Kaler, the president of the University of Minnesota, joins me. We'll discuss the budget he just proposed for the university system. And we'll take your questions on all things you. Join us at 11.
News coverage of business and the economy is supported by Allianz Life Insurance Company of North America, a provider of financial solutions, including fixed and variable annuities and life insurance. Allianz, helping put the awe in your retirement. Online at allianzlife.com.
Talking volumes tomorrow night, Carl Hiaasen in the house. By the way, if you missed my conversation, played a bit of it here this morning with Elizabeth Alexander, you can find it on the podcast. Played it yesterday at noon, so on the podcast. And Talking Volumes tomorrow night with Carl Hiaasen at 7 o'clock. Back to my conversation this hour, Denis Bouchard with me in the studio. We're talking about his new novel, Into the Sun, and he's at the new Milkweed bookstore tonight. We think it's 6 o'clock.
Yes.
Okay. We'll verify that before the hour is over. This is a story told in a conflict zone in Afghanistan through the eyes of some of the members of the expat community that are drawn there. And the narrator in one part of the novel tells us something that I thought was pretty intriguing. All expats shared more than we like to admit, a sense of addiction, an uncertainty about what we'd do if we went home, a feeling of being awakened. So awakened how?
Awakened in the sense that they are in a setting where there's so much danger, first of all, so much uncertainty. And I guess, the way to say it is the senses are awakened. You walk into the street, you notice every detail. You notice what's going on all around you. The culture is so dramatically different that you have to be in a heightened state of awareness all the time to catch interactions, to understand the nuances, to figure out what's safe and what's not. And compared to living at home where you can walk out your front door, go to the store, do everything in sort of, a state of partial awareness.
Yeah.
It is like being on drugs. You're highly awakened.
How do you know? No. Just kidding. Doesn't that sense of vigilance, awareness diminish after a while of being in a war zone? I mean, how long have you spent periods at a time when you're conflict
four months at a time.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess. I think everybody I know, most of my friends who, even if they're there for a year, they all say when they go back home, they crash. They sleep, they sleep a lot. The adrenaline drops. It depends on what's happening, right? It depends on what's happening at that moment politically. Last time I was there was in 2014 during the elections. And it was a very bad time for expats. A lot of expats were being killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everyone I knew looked like they were in a heightened state of awareness.
Really?
They looked very stressed. Journalists were being killed every now and then, and usually by people who were in positions to protect, sometimes by people who were in positions to protect them, the police or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So people, I think, were very much awakened, very on edge. And that reflected in their personalities and in their behavior. But it's also, you know, in that excerpt that you read, or the line you read, mm-hmm. it talks about how hard it is to go home.
Yeah.
And there it's hard to go home for a number of reasons. One is you're used to living a certain heightened experience of the world, but they're also used to being at the epicenter of, you know, global politics, of, you know, the discussion around America's longest lasting war. They're posting on Facebook. They're, you know, they've created personas that of people who are commenting to everyone they know about this war from a place of real authority. And to go back home and give that up is pretty difficult.
Which you did.
Yes, I did. For now.
Yeah.
What I found is that it takes a while for me to write what I've experienced. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to come back and have a quiet moment to digest it all and get it into a book form. But I still do travel overseas a fair bit.
You know, I'm kind of surprised to hear you refer to reporters, war correspondents, as expats. That's not how I think of expats, but...
It depends. Some of them come in just to report,
uh-huh.
But some of them live there for years, you know, and they are part of the expat community.
Yeah, what does it mean, do you think, for a journalist to become part of the expat community?
What does it mean? It depends on the journalist, right? I mean, I think that it can be positive, and, you know, it depends on that expat community too. Somebody who's spending years in Afghanistan, I think, is better positioned to understand what's actually happening there. So, you know, sometimes you see a journalist come in for a week and they do a bunch of reporting. That's oftentimes the reporting I find most questionable when I see it. And the people I know who've been there for years, I think they know the community much better, but they also can get very anchored in that expat community.
Yeah.
Which
that's
kind
of what I'm asking.
Can become its own culture.
Right.
And in a sense can create distance as well. I don't think there's one good solution, and, you know, they're all sort of fraught with their dangers.
I mean, there is value to the parachuting in journalist, right, who comes in and draws attention to what's happening that you're not going to get, except for the well-known NBC News reporter who parachutes in for 2 weeks and does it. I mean, there is some value
there
to that,
some value,
isn't there?
Absolutely. I think there's more value to it when it's not their first time there, when they actually spend some time there and then they come back. I personally find that without spending at least a few months in a country, and that's the bare minimum, it's really hard to understand much of what's going on. Because I think if you're just parachuting in without having spent a few months there, most of what you know is from other people's reporting.
True.
And so, you know, how are you actually forming your own views? Unless you have some connection to the country or speak the language or something, I do think it's slightly questionable.
How long did it take you to figure that out?
I found that each time I've gone to a country overseas, I thought I understood a lot of things. So we take the Congo, for example, where I've spent some time and I wrote a book about the Congo. You know, when I first arrived, I thought I understood what was going on very well from having read a lot about it. And I was writing a lot of things in my notes for my book. And a few months into the trip, I began to realize how wrong my perceptions were, how I was completely misinterpreting certain interactions. And that, I think, I'm sure if I spent years, I would even realize more how wrong I've been about certain things.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the experience has taught me to be very wary of what I think I know.
Can you read a little bit from that section of the book where we're learning what happens to people when they spend? Can you see that? I know the lights are kind of dim here.
Yeah, I can.
Okay.
Kabul was a haven for conspiracies. Sooner or later, expats explained away even the most random killing. If a Westerner was shot, a rumor arose that he was feeding information to an embassy or a diplomat, and someone put out a hit. If the deceased was a journalist, people said his writing had been critical of a warlord, when in truth it was hard to write anything about Afghanistan without mentioning warlords or being critical. Some days we agreed on the incompetence of the Afghan security forces. Others we believed they had precise information about everyone and would do anything to maintain the status quo, even kill us. The conspiracies gave us the sense that we were players in a vast intrigue whose chaos hid its order. In this way, they made us feel safe. If we accepted that much of what happened was random, how could we go out our front doors? We repeated stories that stripped others of their innocence so as to enshrine our own and live more fully in its protection.
Denis Bouchard reading from his new novel, Into the Sun. He's at the Milkweed Bookstore. The event starts at 5:30. He goes on at 6:30, and he'll be talking about the novel. So I wanted you to read that part because as somebody who covered campaigns, I remember what it was like when we would get into like the herd, the press, right? And we saw each other every day, and it was, you know, it was great and this long slog, and all we talk about is when it was going to be over, but we loved it while we were doing it. And, you know, conspiracy theories it was fertile ground for that kind of stuff. So, which is what that passage made me think about.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, I'm amazed how many conspiracies abound in every...
Among the journalists, right?
You know, some of the journalists I know absolutely say, no, this is nonsense, this is ridiculous. And then others I know, you know, it's interesting. It depends on individuals. But I was often surprised when I was, you know, living in Kabul, there'd be discussion around somebody who'd been killed. And then I would be talking to someone alone and they'd say, well, you know, there's rumors that this person was actually doing this and was investigating this, and they don't want this uncovered because there was actually that problem actually relates to something else. And there would be this entire story. And then I'd run it by somebody else and say, oh, that's ridiculous. You know, that's impossible, but it might be this. Okay. And I think that my interpretation of that to certain degrees, first of all, we want to understand things. We want to create narratives. We're a narrative species. We're always inventing stories. But I also think that when you walk into the street, and you know that another journalist was shot in the street the week before, it's much easier to walk into the street if you have a story about why he was shot.
That's a good point.
You know, if you can say that he was actually investigating something that was really angering a certain warlord and they had him knocked off, then you can say, I'm pretty safe walking down the street right now.
So, because the randomness is the really scary thing.
The randomness is terrifying.
Because it could happen to you.
Yes.
So how do you deal with that?
Well, I think everyone deals with it in different ways. You know, I'm more of the person who deals with it statistically. I work out, you know, that my odds are still pretty good, you know, even if it was a random
thing.
Until they're not, but you know, if we were rolling dice here, you know, if this were gambling, I'd probably be fine. I am not inclined to try to tell myself that there was a good reason for that person to be killed. In terms of, you know, I don't want to believe I rarely believe the stories around it.
Yeah.
So I don't feel safe in that regard. I tend to just tell myself that my odds are pretty good.
And so far?
So far, yeah. So far, so good.
Do you ever feel like you've, I'm remembering interviewing another war correspondent. I think she spent a lot of time in Iraq, and she said that there was this sense that the longer you test fate in some ways, the more the odds might run out for you.
No, I think they're ever renewing odds. I think it's, you know,
really,
I think it can,
they start afresh when you get there the next time.
It's I don't think you're wearing out your karma. You know? I don't think that you have good luck and then you're burning it up or anything like that. I think it's, you know, it probably statistically, the longer you spend there, the higher likelihood it is you're going to get something bad is going to happen to you. Yeah,
yeah.
But numbers wise, yes. But in terms of, you know, if you have a 1 in 10,000 chance of something bad happening to you on any given day, it stays that every single day. Just you keep on resetting it every day. You're playing roulette every day.
Does your family think that, or is this, do they buy this logic?
Just don't talk about that.
Really?
No, it's not really discussed too much. My mother and I will have a conversation every now and then, but I usually say to her, you know, it's really not as bad as people make it out to be.
Does she believe that, and do you believe that?
Yeah, I believe that. I think it's not as bad as people make it.
Well, who are the people that are making it out to be?
I'd say the media emphasizes the really bad things.
You are part of the media.
I am part of the media. And it emphasizes the bad stuff that happens when it's happening. You know, we hear about the explosions, we hear about the terror attacks. We don't hear about all of the normal things that happen from day to day. And that's why, you know, a lot of the, some of the projects I try to do about women cycling.
I love that story.
I want to emphasize that there's just daily life going on here, and people are doing their activism, and they're working on projects, and it's not terrifying all the time, right? And it's actually terrifying a small portion of
the time. I'll tell you what was great about that story was, I think you're right, we don't hear a lot about that women have made any gains at all.
Right.
And that story told me just because we're not hearing about it doesn't mean it isn't happening.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's a lot of good things happening. And I think that, you know, we can spin what's happening in a country many different ways. And it's, mm-hmm. and it's just not that, it's never that simple. Right. And so my experience in these places is that, you know, I know people who spent years in Kabul and have never seen an attack, never seen anything bad happen.
Can that really be?
Yeah, it's very, it's a big city. It's millions of people living there. I think it's hard not to hear something.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You're going to hear things.
You're going to have awareness about it.
Yeah.
I mean, the...
You even hear things blow up. I mean, I've heard things, I think most people I know have spent time there, I've heard things blow up. But to see them, to be firsthand there, many people never see anything.
You said that very casually. You hear things blow up, but...
But it does become pretty casual when you're there. Yeah, I mean, because, you know, things are blowing up every few weeks. And it's loud.
And
so you can hear it.
And the... What's the lesson of that for you? Or is there not one?
I don't know if there's a lesson for that, you know.
What does that mean, though?
That you can hear things blowing
up.
Well,
to your sense of... You know, what you're reporting on and what it means to be there, to be the messenger of whatever's happening in Kabul for your readers.
Right. I guess it depends on, I sort of see it as I'm one person among many who's telling stories about this. And, I think there's a bit of a media ecosystem that we don't always discuss. And
well, yeah, so let's discuss that.
So I think sometimes it's, you know, and it's even one of the reasons I wrote this book. You know, I think that there's certain stories that are told all the time, repeatedly, you know, and you just run across them, you know, a certain kind of classic story and a certain kind of attack that we tend to emphasize. And I think that there are other stories that just receive significantly less attention. So I'll find, you know, if I hear something blow up, I know that it's going to be all over the news feeds. And I think, that's not something that I need to rush off and tell. There's probably something more important that I need to address. Huh. And I'll focus on that.
That's the kind of confidence that's probably gained from having done this kind of work for so long. Right.
Yeah, I think maybe sort of a realism.
You can say I know better than to rush over there, and that's my story of the day, or
right.
whatever.
Yeah. Well, I also think there's this distinction to be made. You know, there's sort of people talk a lot about, and even doing an embed with the military. The military people I worked with talked about this a lot too, which is journalists who seem more like war tourists, who are actually, you know, not doing substantive reporting, but are, you know, really interested in being in contact with war. And I heard people refer to this often in Afghanistan, sort of, you know, oh, you know, so-and-so is a bit of a war tourist. He, you know, he just wants to see the firefights and the attacks. And you'd kind of, there would be certain people who rush off to every attack who weren't even filing a story, weren't even filing photos. They just
really
wanted to get close to it.
Wow.
I can understand that impulse. I can, you know, but I also think that it's not spectacle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I think it's important to make sure we don't present it as spectacle, that we present it in context, that we talk about the impact that it has on the lives of the Afghans. It's very easy to dramatize our experiences as foreigners observing a war and forget that this is what the Afghans have been living with for decades. And, you know, it's very important to keep it in context.
You know what I'm curious about is what you read when you're in these conflict zones in Afghanistan.
Oh, I mean, I do read a lot of what other people I know.
Do you?
Yeah. I want to see what they're working on, and I want to see how they're portraying it.
No, I don't mean journalism.
Yeah.
I really meant literature.
You mean like not fiction? Or
yeah.
In terms of fiction, yeah. What did I read? You haven't forced me. I mean, I read so much different stuff.
Do you have time to?
Yeah, I definitely
to read for kind of pleasure and.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not all that different from what I read here, actually. Sort of, you know, I'm kind of keeping up with the books that are new, that are coming out, that are getting attention. I have my list of books that I've been trying to catch up on.
I asked that, though, because you talked about the awareness, the kind of vigilant sense. Yeah. And I thought, are there some books that lend themselves to that experience?
That lend themselves to the experience of the vigilant sense?
I mean, maybe I'm not going to read Edith Wharton in The War Zone.
Right.
I don't know.
Or
maybe it's a little too quiet.
Maybe it's what you want is quiet.
Maybe,
you know,
it is.
I normally sleep with earplugs in, and I'm someone who, if I hear the slightest sound, I wake up. And I have earplugs in when I write in the United States all the time. There's always earplugs in. And when I was in Afghanistan, it was the exact opposite. Unless I was here, you know. I wanted to be able to hear every little sound, you know? And so I was never, you know, I couldn't sleep unless I could hear the sounds in the street. It completely switched. And so reading something peaceful was probably just fine.
Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Denis Bouchard's novel is called Into the Sun. He'll talk about it tonight at the Milkweed Bookstore.